May it please the Court, Your Honors. Thank you for taking this case and tackling this very difficult area of the law. It needs it. When a supervisor orders a co-employee into a known position of peril, and known is the very important operative word there, that supervisor, under this court's jurisprudence, under Steinhauser and Jewell, violates a personal duty of care independent of any of the employer's non-delegable duties. The law in this area has come full circle from its roots in the common law as it coursed through following the passage of the Workers' Compensation Act in 1926, and then into the post-Vidami world of something more. And now it's back to the common law. And I think all of the Court of Appeals cases recently agree that we're back to the common law. So what was the law in the common law? I think the way, in response to some of Judge Wilson and
what
Judge
what is there about this?
I'm sorry?
What is there about the, what is there that changed the analysis of the something more doctrine?
Well, I think, and I think Leeper discussed how something more under Vidami was a correct statement of the common law. Something more is nothing more than a restatement of the common law in its original state as stated in Vidami.
Which means that the change in the statute doesn't really change anything, because yeah. I mean, the statute, liberal or conservative, it's whatever, it was common law liability was the same as you said, Vidami said it creates sort of a statutory immunity, but it was really just restating the common law and trying to...
Yes.
Basically, so if the statute never said employee, but it always recognized common law employees were not liable for non-delegable duties, were liable for personal duties.
Correct. That's a correct statement of the common law.
No.
But the I think where you can put the liberal versus construction strict construction in a box, and just to say, because of the liberal construction, co-employees or employees were considered the employer, and they had immunity.
But
once that was gone, we're back to the common law.
But I'm asking, maybe that was the mistake. I'm not sure liberal or not has anything to do with it. If they're not the employer, if they're not mentioned, but in effect, they're treated as the employer's alter ego. And I think it was just a shorthand. Those cases ended up confusing the law by using a shorthand, saying they're their employer, but really, in effect, to the extent they're carrying out the employer's non-delegable duty, they might as well be, because they're not independently liable.
Yeah, and I think, and I don't think anybody, I don't disagree that an employee carrying out an employer's non-delegable duty is not liable and never has been under the common law. That I don't think that's the issue here. I think the issue here is, and Your Honor pointed to it, can they coexist? And I think Judge Wilson said, can you have both of them? I think the answer is absolutely yes.
Okay.
And I'll give you in Jewell, for instance, it was a malfunctioning milling machine that injured the plaintiff. And in that case, the supervisor ordered that plaintiff to use that machine into this known position of danger. And the court found that the co-employee supervisor was jointly liable with the employer. The employer was liable for the malfunctioning machine, because providing a safe machine is one of these non-delegable duties. And the co-employee was liable for his negligence in ordering the plaintiff into this position of peril.
But you also have cases like Hansen said, if you simply, at least I read Hansen to say, and that was Court of Appeals, so it may be right or wrong, that if you simply do your non-delegable duty negligently, that doesn't make you liable, because that's part of your job as the employee. You have, and while something more is sort of a trick, I think gets us into, is what causes trouble, because it has all sorts of different meanings. You have to have something on which to base an independent duty. An increased risk is one thing. It may not be the only thing.
Well, but what I think you have to do, Your Honor, is you have to step back and figure out what is being done. What's the conduct that we're involved with?
Mm-hmm.
In Grazik, for instance, it was a steam hammer. And the court said the steam hammer was working fine. That's the employer's non-delegable duty. But when somebody operates it negligently, that is on the co-employee. I think there is a delineation these duties coexist at the job site. At the job site, the employer has these five non-delegable duties, and co-employees also have a duty. This court said it in Logsdon versus Duncan and in Silcox. In Logsdon, the court said that co-employee duty is governed by the most elemental principles of tort liability. Co-employees owe each other the duty to exercise care in the prosecution of their work. There is a duty. I realize that duty is a legal question. It's a threshold question in every case. We normally don't get caught up in it because if you're dealing with an invitee at a store, that defines the duty. But it is a threshold question. But I think this court has answered it a long time ago, that co-employees owe each other personal duties of care. Now, as Judge Fisher said, if the pleading, if we deal with it on the pleading and we look at it and we say, you have pled nothing more than providing a safe workplace, you've pled nothing more than a failure to promulgate rules, you've pled nothing more than providing safe equipment, that the trial judge can handle at the pleading stage on a motion to dismiss. That's part of one of the employer's non-delegable duties, and this employee who's wearing two hats, this employee may not have a duty in that regard. But if the pleadings are that the employee has either sent the person into a position of peril, I think knowledge is the key, because duty in its core is about foreseeability, and foreseeability is about knowledge. When a co-employee who knows or should know that something he or she is about to do and does it and injures a co-employee, he has breached his personal duty of care.
But, okay, in looking at Hansen, it quoted from Kelso, the non-delegable duties are duties of the employer to his employees and not of fellow servants to each other. It refused to impose on co-employees a legal duty to fellow employees to perform an employer's non-delegable duties because it's beyond the control of the employee. The employee has to carry out his job. And as applied here, for instance, if the employer had said, you must stack baskets six high and carry them six high, and the employee had done exactly that, are you saying the employee would have been liable in negligence for doing what it was the employee's job to do? Or is your argument that the employer simply said, you got to move the baskets, and it was the employee going beyond that and picking an unduly unsafe method of moving them, which created an independent liability in this case? But it's not because he did the exact job he was told, it's because he did something different than was strictly required by his work requirements.
I think just...
I may not be articulating...
You are. You're articulating as well as anybody can. I think the knowledge that Mr. Terrio had about the danger takes it out of just carrying out the job. And it invokes the personal duty that a co-employee has.
No, I mean, that's the step, though, because ordinarily, no matter how much you know, you don't have a duty to act at common law.
Unless you have a duty.
Well, yes, and that's a little circular. So what is it that gives him the duty to act based on that knowledge? And if it's because he's an employer, an employee, or a supervisor, then it looks to me like we're under the non-delegable duty.
It doesn't, because he has a personal duty recognized by this court of exercising due care in relation to his co-employees. He has that personal duty.
Are you saying he has to pick a method? If he's not controlled in his method and he chooses the method, he can be liable if he chooses an unsafe method of fulfilling his employer's duties?
I believe that's the common law.
Well, then why is it the employer liable for not ordering a safe method? Why isn't it a failure of the employer's duty to provide a safe workplace, safe means and methods?
I believe it may be both. And I think there's a good case to look at, Your Honors. It's the Biller case. In that case, the co-employee manager was training his young worker on how to use a tree trimming machine. And during the course of that training, the trainee got called away, and the manager decided, well, I'll just finish the work we were doing that I was showing him. And in the process of doing that, he crushed and killed the the trainee who was doing something else. The court said the training to provide adequate, competent employees, safe place to work, that was the part of the employer's duty. So when he was training that trainee, he had an employer's hat on, the employer's duty hat on. But once he couldn't find him, the employer's duty ended. And when he decided to go ahead and do the work, and he did it negligently, and he caused this terrible injury and death, his own duty began. I think, you know, it's a function of the facts. It's a function of what's going on at the job site. But these duties coexist. Sometimes they intersect, but they're there. Just because we have these five non-delegable duties, it doesn't mean that's the exclusive duties that are at the job site. Doesn't mean that at all, in my opinion. It's that those five are on the employer for sure, and the question for this court and any trial court is to decide the facts as pled, do those invoke one of those employer duties, or does it invoke something that isn't one of those duties? And if so, the personal duty that each employee owes to each other is invoked.
That's not the same as saying they can be both. You just said, did they plead a duty that was not one of those duties, which sounds like they are exclusive.
If it's part of the non-delegable duty, it can't be independent, is what he's saying. So it's you've got to be saying it's
separate. I didn't mean to say that, and that's not the point I'm trying to make. The point I'm trying to make is it's a function of the facts that are pled. In this case, for instance, in our case, we pled that Mr. Terrio was told that these dowel baskets were stacked too high in a dangerous way, and he told them to move them anyway like that, and they fell on him. What if the facts were, as Mr. Peters is standing, getting ready to unload these dowel baskets, but he hasn't undone the straps, and the straps break? That's on the employer, the failure to provide safe equipment. And they fall. And it's a combination of the two. The strap breaking, and if the evidence is that it... My time is up. Can I finish my response? If the evidence is that both of those combined to cause the fall. In other words, if the strap had held, it wouldn't have fallen. And if they weren't stacked that high, it wouldn't have fallen. That's where both of those duties come into play, in my opinion. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. You have time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the Court?
You may proceed.
You all have heard a little bit about co-employee liability this morning, so I'm going to just jump in with where we are, you know, in the conversation now. And I want to just first address this idea of whether or not the duties can exist together. In part, what I would say is that we don't have to decide that in some ways in this case, because there isn't an allegation, like Mr. Dowd was just talking about, where there are two different duties coexisting at the same time that both went into causation. And I think that Leeper would contemplate that where a safe workplace is provided, so where the employer meets its duties, then the personal duties of the employee take over. That at that point, once the employers are satisfied, then you know you're outside of those non-delegable duties and you're within the personal duties of the employees. We wouldn't argue that co-employees don't have duties when they come to work every day that coexist with the duties of the employer to provide the safe workplace. But I think when you look at a particular injury, that's the discussion that has to be had.
But the elevator case, the elevator hoist case, and I'm not sure if that's Toshert, that was their job, was to repair the elevator, but the person picked this method of doing that was his own creation and increased the risk. It was his duty to repair the elevator and to do it safely, but he had an independent duty under Toshert, which is the decision of this court, because he created a situation in which there was greater risk, more chance of injury that wasn't necessary sort of to the performance of the, wasn't part of the job as described.
Right.
And why isn't that what Mr. Dowd has pled here, that this person needed to move the baskets, but he chose, after being told it was too high and it was dangerous, to stack them really high and make them move them high, and they fell and hurt him? And why isn't that like the elevator hoist?
The difference there is that in the elevator case, the employee came up with their own manner. That's what you keep going back to. I think that another case
that's what he said the supervisor/employee did here, and saying, no, you're going to stack them that high because that wasn't required.
No, in the pleadings in this case, in fact, what they're pleading is that the baskets came in a particular manner. They were stored in the same manner. They were transported in the same manner. That they made very clear in their position that this was the standard operating procedure of this employer. And the point that they actually make in the petition, what the heart of their argument is, for liability, is that other employees had made note of the fact that it was stacked too high. They felt that it was a safety concern. They raised these safety concerns with Patrick Theriault, and their complaint is that Patrick Theriault did not address those safety concerns before ordering the baskets out on that day. And I think that there, again, when you look at that progression of facts, what you're looking at is, and again, it goes a little bit to some of the other issues that we've been talking about today, is the other co-employees were not sued here. The employees that said, hey, that's unsafe, they weren't sued. Well, the reason they weren't sued is because they don't have a duty to step in and fix it. The reason they don't have a duty to step in and fix it is because they're not supervisors. The only reason that Patrick Theriault is the one that's in this litigation is because they allege that he had the control over the manner in which that baskets were transported.
Well, and he gets that control from the employer.
Exactly,
that,
Your Honor.
That authority or power that he didn't use adequately or safely is given him by the employer. He didn't walk into the job site with it.
Exactly, and I think too that's something that's important that goes to what Judge Denver Stith is talking about, which is that where you have a supervisor that then takes on that duty as opposed to all of these other co-employees, you have a very targeted duty.
Is that any different than Tauscher, where it was his duty to fix the elevator and they came in? And that was his duty, and he had control over that, but his method was his own creation.
Right.
And it's what caused the problem. And here they're alleging, and the jury may well find, not, but why isn't it a jury question whether he created the risk by nothing in the employer's directions to him required him to move them in that manner?
Well, and that's again here. If you say, okay, well, the supervisor is the one who decided the manner in which the standard operating procedure was going to be, then at that point, for supervisors, there's always going to be somebody liable, because the only way that an employer can decide the manner in which work is going to be done is through its employees. And so, and that's what they've alleged here. Well, Patrick Theriault, as the supervisor, is the one who set up how these baskets were going to be stacked. As a supervisor,
I'm sorry, can you explain why we don't have to overrule Tauscher? I've been trying to ask why this case is not like that. Can you just address for me, is that wrongly decided then, you think, and you need to overrule it?
I think that, again, in that case, that there isn't an allegation of the standard of procedure. So, in other words, I understand what you're saying, that they had a duty to repair and they chose the manner. Well, here, the employer chose the manner. That Patrick Theriault, as an individual co-employee, didn't choose the manner. That it was standard operating procedure established by the employer as to how these baskets were going to be transported.
And that's not a fact question as to whether he was required to do it that way or not?
Well, I don't think that there was a written document that said this is how you must do it, but I think that there was a standard operating procedure in place that the plaintiffs have recognized and actually pled into their petition. And so at the point that you have a standard operating procedure, you have a manner of work that is established by the employer. And the fact that he's the one who established it as the employer shouldn't then open liability, because if that's the case, again, every time there's a workplace accident, that somebody created the manner. And so I'm not sure where there wouldn't be a supervisor standing there.
I'm not sure where there would ever be an independent duty under your standard, though. You would never have liability.
Oh, I think absolutely there would be an independent duty. I think that McCarver is actually a good case to look at, which is the mining case with the rock. Supervisor ordered the employee to remove rock from the roof that collapsed. And there, again, it's this struggle of where does the supervisor hat come in, where is it taken off? And there, again, that court emphasized the fact that the foreseeability may have established the duty, but who the duty belonged to was established by the standard operating procedure. Again, in the McCarver case, he didn't do what their standard procedure was in testing the rock to ensure that it was going to be safe to remove. And so I think that if you look at these cases closely over and over again, that that's where the supervisors get in trouble. If you take a guy and you dangle him over a vat of boiling water, that may have been not just your decision of how to conduct.
But if you do that every week, then it's okay and you're not liable.
I think at some point, if you do that every day, that is the employer's non-delegable duty to step in and say no. And in fact, there have been cases. There's the Johnson case, which is another steam hammer case, where the supervisor did exactly that. He told his employees, this is the way we're going to use the steam hammer. The employer was ultimately by the court designated the duty, saying the employer should have stepped in and said, no, that is not the manner in which we're going to do this because it's not safe, because it is the employer's non-delegable duty to provide a safe workplace. Here, there was a standard operating procedure. Safety concerns were raised. I'm not even saying it wasn't Patrick Terrio's duty to recognize and do something about those safety issues, but if he had that duty, it was as the employer, because he was acting as the employer when he was supervising that employee under standard operating procedure. As you said, throughout Missouri, there has been recognition. I think that all of the changes that we've seen over the years have changed the words that we use. I don't think the intention has changed in the past 80 years that there's a set of non-delegable duties that an employer has and that you have to have an independent duty outside of that. And that independent duty comes when there's something more. And under my analysis, I think squarely that it would be easy to find that a supervisor had a personal duty as well, and that they violated a personal duty because they're not acting as the employer at the moment that they make the decision.
And that's the McCarver case.
It's the McCarver case. It's the run it till it blows case. It's the dangle a guy over a vat of boiling water case. The case law is rife with examples of that.
Wouldn't all of those cases also have been properly decided under proximate cause, that the employer didn't have any reason to expect and Tauscher that the guy was going to do what he did? Didn't have any reason to think employees need to be protected from that? Same in McCarver. You know, those cases are so, well, not Tauscher, but all the other cases we're discussing are pre-work comp, common law cases, fellow servant doctrine cases. And wouldn't they, in modern parlance, have been proximate cause cases? And isn't that a basis for distinguishing these precedents?
Yeah, I think that, again, in each of these cases, there's that question of what does the employer know, almost? It's that the employer shouldn't be tagged with liability because its supervisors decided to do something stupid, for lack of a better word, you know, not to be cheeky, but, you know, that should an employer be held liable when, its foreman decides that...
the word's foreseeable.
I think that foreseeability isn't a non-issue in cases on duty. I just think that foreseeability doesn't answer the question of delegable versus non-delegable duties. I think the question of delegable duties versus non-delegable duties comes down to what can the employer expect its employees to do, and at what point does the supervisor step outside of its actions importing back to the employer. And so, again, I mean, you dangle a guy from a vat of boiling or over a vat of boiling water, arguably you're not working as for the benefit of the employer anymore. You know, I mean, at that point, you're off on your own doing something a little crazy. And, you know, I do think that proximate cause is an interesting way of looking at that, if you trace it back of, you know, what, again, can the employer expect that its supervisors are going to do on its behalf, what its agents are doing on its behalf. And again, here, I just would have to go back and say that Termar had to know that this is what was being done. I mean, this was the standard operating procedure. And that, you know, when he decided to, this is the way they were going to be, you know, kept, and this is the way they were going to be transported, he did it as the employer, and it's the employer's duty to have a safe workplace. I think, again, the Lieber case doesn't significantly change a lot of the law that's been applied in Missouri. I think that the two-step test that Lieber seems to imagine of, you know, determine whether or not there's a safe workplace, and then you determine, you know, if there was a safe workplace, whether or not there could be co-employee liability, I think, is the same type of argument that Kelso was making all the way back into common law and carries all the way through.
Well,
and
doesn't Lieber, in effect, though, make the jury a determiner of duty? And that is not what we do.
I agree. I think that they are squarely wrong in their implication in the case that there's a fact question that has to be decided before you reach the duty. I will tell you that our law firm is dealing with summary judgment motions that are being denied and jury instructions as a result. And, it is an unworkable standard. The mess that we are dealing with these jury instructions leading out of Lieber, I can't stress to you enough that it would be lovely for you guys to step in and look at that issue, because it's, trying to come up with jury instructions that apply facts to a duty that the court doesn't even know yet. The court hasn't decided what the duty is just almost an impossible task for the trial judges out there to do and the parties to try and deal with during trial. So that's my little soapbox on that issue. I think here, if you take that outside of Lieber, which I obviously would disagree with the rest of Lieber, it doesn't change anything. It again recognizes that you have to have a safe workplace, that the employer has to meet the duty to provide a safe workplace before you get to the co-employee liabilities. And here, they didn't do that. There wasn't a safe workplace. And not only that, they don't allege there was a safe workplace. And I can tell you that Judge Norton, who sent this case up here for you, and I had a spirited debate, to say the least, in the Court of Appeals, and the one thing that Judge Norton fully agreed with me is that the plaintiffs did not plead a personal duty in this case. He admits it in his dissent and says only that, well, we should infer that they would come up with that during the litigation of the case. And I don't think that's appropriate.
Well, was this dismissed on summary judgment on a motion?
It was on motion to dismiss.
So normally you allow people to replead. That's true.
Normally you would allow them to replead. I wasn't the trial attorney. All I can tell you is that there wasn't a motion to replead in the case. And so I think in this case, frankly, they would have a difficult time repleading because I don't think that Patrick Theriault did anything outside of his duties as as the employer. I think they pled what they believe, which is that he should have addressed the safety concerns before he sent out the baskets. I think that's what they believe. I think that's what the basis of liability is here, and I don't think that is outside of the non-delegable duties of the employer. So I see that I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
So what takes it out of the employer's non-delegable duty?
Well, I think it's not his role as a supervisor. He is not the employer. He is an individual. And what it takes it out is what he does. And that's what, in all of these cases, it's what they do.
What did you plead in this case?
Case was that he was told that this was a dangerous way to double stack these dowel baskets, and despite being warned about that and complained about that, he instructed Mr. Peters on that day, September 24th, 2008, to move those dowel baskets double stacked.
And what if it was the employer's practice to always move dowel baskets as they're received, and they're received in that double stacked manner? Then is that an independent breach of an independent duty, or is that just following his job?
Well, if he's a coworker, I think that's a hard one to hoe. But as a supervisor with authority, and we pled that immediately after this accident, he ordered everybody to single stack them. So he obviously had the authority on how these were to be stacked. So I think it depends on who, it depends on what their role is, and it depends on what their power is. In this case, I think he had the authority to do it, and we pled that he did. I think if you look on duty, take for instance a licensee versus invitee case. The trial court can easily handle that issue based on the facts pled. Do the facts pled invoke an invitee type duty, or do they invoke a licensee type duty? That's something that courts do in this state all day long. I think they could do it here. on whether are the facts as pled, do they invoke the employer's, one of the employer's non-delegable duties, or do they invoke a personal duty on the part of the co-employee? I think it's workable, and I don't think Leeper has respectfully has done it right. Leeper's done a lot of good things, but I don't think they got that one right. Let me just talk about the standard operating procedures. I think that's been addressed by this court in Grazik and in Kelso. In Grazik, the court said plaintiff's injury was attributable to a danger incidental to the performance of the duties of the coworker. The negligence of a competent fellow employee is an operative detail of the work they are engaged in and will support a claim directly for personal liability against the co-employee. I think Grazik addresses it, and I think Kelso does with this quote, Your Honors. An employer's obligation to provide a safe workplace does not extend to protecting them from the transitory risks which are created by the negligence of the servants themselves in carrying out the details of the work. Mr. Terrio was carrying out the details of the work when he ordered Mr. Peters into this position of danger. That is not part of the employer's duty to provide a safe workplace.
How is it a transitory risk if it's been going on so long that all these other employees complained about it and the negligent act was a failure to rectify it?
I think those cases, they talk about habit and policies that are in place where they try to sue the co-employee for not fixing it. The distinction in those cases is that the co-employee who's being sued has not been told, the way you're making me do it is dangerous. I think that's the distinction, Your Honor. I think it's the knowledge which goes to duty, which goes to foreseeability, and I'll end on that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. The matter be taken under submission.